From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Healthcare reform, competition, and the public option. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. There's a rare consensus in Washington that this is the moment for healthcare reform if Congress takes action before the end of this year. With protracted wrangling, the opportunity could be lost, and debate has bogged down over a public plan to compete with private insurance. Would it help maintain high quality at reduced cost? Would it drive insurance companies out of the healthcare business? We'll look at the pros and cons and at competing efforts to shape a winning message. What are the roles of ideology, media manipulation, and money? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the missing governor, the mistress, and the Republican Party. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. The debate over health care reform is coming down to the wire at the White House and Congress and in the media. We'll look at the pros and cons of the so-called public option and at the influence of ideology and money. On Reporter's Notebook, another politician betrays his wife. Did Governor Mark Sanford also damaged the Republican Party? First, this news update. The U.S. Supreme Court today upheld the rights of students to be protected from unreasonable search in the case of a 13-year-old who was stripped by school authorities in Arizona. Jess Braven covers the court for The Wall Street Journal. And, Jess, good to have you on our program.
Hello, Warren.
Should have said a 13-year-old girl. I think that's very important in that case. Why was she stripped?
She was stripped because the school in Safford, Arizona, had a zero-tolerance policy about drugs of any kind, including painkillers like Advil or ibuprofen. And a fellow student who was caught with some of these ibuprofen pills accused the 13-year-old, Savannah Redding, of having given them to her.
Okay, so then they took her in the office. What did they do?
Well, the assistant principal, who's a man, went over, took Savannah to the office, said that your friend has said that you gave her the pills and you're going to distribute more at lunchtime. I want to search your backpack. Savannah said, okay, and the assistant principal did that. He didn't find anything. So he then asked two female school employees to search her clothes, and this was the school nurse and another female employee. They took Savannah into another room. They had her take off her outer clothes, didn't find these pills. Then they had her take off her undershirt, and then the court explains shake out her bra and underpants, you know, pull the elastic out so in case she had hidden any pills in that area, they would have fallen out. No pills were found on Savannah.
Okay. Now, in the course of deliberations, when the arguments were made before the court, Justice Ginsburg, the only woman on the court, indicated that she was pretty concerned about this. Does it appear that she helped to carry the day?
Well, you know, it's hard to know what happens between the oral arguments, which are in public, and the announcement of the opinion today. The court doesn't explain how it reaches its conclusions. But, and this is not really evident from the written transcript, but if you were in the courtroom that day, as I was, you could see that several of the male justices didn't immediately seem to grasp what the big deal was. Justice Breyer said, well, you have to get undressed down to your underwear to change for gym. And Justice Souter asked why this was so significant, and he compared it to the school's interest in trying to suppress drug abuse. Justice Ginsburg, from the tone of her voice, from the way she interjected, made it very clear that for a pubescent girl, perhaps not yet comfortable in her changing body, having to display herself in this way, and part of her breasts were exposed and her pelvic area were exposed, according to the court, this was a degrading and humiliating event. She hinted that this was, in fact, part of the reason you'd like to have more women on the court, so they would bring this experience to interpreting words in the Constitution like unreasonable, because that's ultimately what this gets down to. Was this an unreasonable search, which is the term the Fourth Amendment uses in describing the protection that all people have?
All right. Now, Justice Souter was the one who wrote the opinion, and everybody voted for it except Clarence Thomas. It was an 8-1 decision. Is this surprising, given the fact that in the past the court has upheld such things as urine tests for drugs among students?
It was surprising, certainly to me, because just 2 years ago, the court found it permissible by a closer margin, but still found it permissible to suppress First Amendment rights that students might have for the same purpose, to eradicate drug abuse or use on campus. That was the famous Bong Hits for Jesus case, where a student was punished for unfurling a banner that said that rather elusive idea in front of the school campus. So and several justices talked about the overriding importance of fighting drug abuse being even more important than letting students express themselves. So for the court to, by such a wide margin, flip and say that, well, the Fourth Amendment right here in this instance is more important than what the school is up to, was quite surprising.
So why was this so unreasonable, according to the opinion today from Justice Souter, and what does it mean for students' rights in the future?
It was unreasonable for a number of things. It was unreasonable because the school assistant principal had almost no grounds to seriously suspect Savannah Redding of being a drug dealer, in addition to the fact that she was drug distributor, and in addition to the fact that she was an honor student who had never been in trouble before. The only evidence that he had was that the classmate said, "Savannah gave these to me." The assistant principal didn't follow up, such as with any questions to test how truthful this statement might have been. He didn't ask when or how or why. He just took it at face value and immediately went to get Savannah. So that's one reason, basically having no serious evidence, just an unsubstantiated accusation like that. The second reason was that even if this accusation were true, the harm that Savannah could have caused the school by having some ibuprofen pills stuck inside her bra was minimal if she already had been isolated. In other words, the principal already has her in the school office. There are many other ways he could have addressed this issue, short of having what the court considered to be a degrading and perhaps traumatizing strip search.
All right. We don't have time to go into the issue of what this means for student rights in the future. We will have to explore that later. In the meantime, Jess Braven, legal affairs writer for The Wall Street Journal, thanks as always for being with us.
My pleasure, Warren.
In a moment, healthcare reform, competition, and the public option on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Last night, ABC News televised a so-called town hall from the Obama White House. Today on Capitol Hill, committees were meeting both in public and behind closed doors while thousands rallied on the streets outside. It's all about health care reform, and debate is focused on quality, on cost, and on proposals for a government-sponsored alternative to private insurance, the so-called public option. Drew Armstrong is health care reporter for Congressional Quarterly, and Drew, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure.
It appears that the single-payer option is off the table, as we say, so for those who advocate it, the public option is the best that they can do. The president has proposed it. How is the opposition breaking down?
Well, there's actually a substantial amount of opposition to this idea of a government-run so-called public option insurance plan that a lot of liberal Democrats are pushing for to compete with private insurance companies. Now, Republicans generally are very opposed to the plan, as are private insurance companies, because they think it would put them out of business. In the Democratic caucus, which has been in control of the process of writing health care legislation in Congress, there's varying support. More liberal Democrats in the House and the Senate think it's absolutely necessary, while there are some moderates in the Senate, where a lot of the attention is being focused, who want to push a modified version of this government-run insurance plan, maybe not get the government involved, in order to gain as much bipartisan support as they can.
How would they change it?
Well, there's this idea floating around right now called a co-op. It's a consumer-owned insurance plan, essentially, that would be given some government seed money to start up and some technical support, and then would eventually be detached from the government. It's modeled on, if you live in a rural state, a rural utility cooperative where it's consumer-owned, and it's essentially a nonprofit that provides the same service as a private market entity, but at a lower cost, and you know, with the focus being on the consumer, not necessarily the shareholder.
How is it different from the so-called public option or government-run plan?
Well, the public option would be largely government-controlled, and it's unclear exactly what that would mean. There are there's a lot of pressure from some moderates, if the public option does get in there, to put limits on it, to make it operate more like a private insurer so that it would still have to negotiate with doctors and hospitals. It wouldn't just be able to set prices, and that it wouldn't have so much government funding that it could just undercut the prices of private insurers and drive them out of business.
Much of the focus, of course, is on cost control. So how is it that those who say that they want the government plan propose to have cost control if there's government subsidies?
Well, the idea is that cost control means a lot of different things. If you're a consumer, you know, it means one thing because you want your premiums to go down. That's your cost. If you're the government, you're trying to pay less. You know, if you're a taxpayer, you're trying to pay less money to fund the thing. The idea, though, is with the public plan that it could pay some lower prices. It would try to undercut the insurers in some ways and force their prices down, you know, and it would also change the way that doctors get paid, perhaps, or that hospitals get paid to make that more efficient, all with the idea of forcing changes in the way private plans operate, both in how expensive they are and also how they pay people, all with the goal of lowering total healthcare spending.
Polls seem to show that the public likes the public option. Why is there then so much opposition to it on Capitol Hill?
Well, I think that there's a lot of public support for the general idea. A lot of the polling that's out there is not very nuanced, to be honest with you. This is such a complex question, and trying to distill it down into, you know, one top line on a poll, do you or do you not support the public option, doesn't really get to the essence of a lot of the trade-offs that have to be made. You know, people say, yes, we support a public option, but then you ask them, do you support higher taxes? And they say, no. Well, the public option is going to cost money, and that has to come from somewhere. Even, you know, it'll either be taxes or cuts to other government programs. When you start to get to the nuance, I think you see some of the support for a public option break down. That's a little bit more awareness of that on Capitol Hill and of the political trade-offs that have to get made to get enough votes for this to get through.
Drew Armstrong again, the healthcare reporter for the Congressional Quarterly. Richard Kirsch is National Campaign Director for Healthcare for Americans. That's a coalition of organizations that are fighting for what they call quality, affordable healthcare for everyone. And Richard Kirsch, thanks very much for joining us today.
Right. Great to be with you, Warren, and great to hear from Drew, too.
How do you get past this issue that quality and affordable may or may not be that a public option may or may not be the best way to accomplish those things?
Well, we think it is an incredibly important way to do it. And at Healthcare for America Now, we're looking at several things. We want to be sure that healthcare is affordable to people with good benefits, that we're regulating the private insurance industry so they can't continue to have spend all their time delaying and denying care. And we think we need a public health insurance option to do the two things the president says it needs to do, which is to lower costs and keep the insurance companies honest. As Drew said, there's lots of ways that public health insurance option can do that. It can do it through getting better rates from providers. It can do it through lowering administrative costs. You know, Medicare has much lower administrative costs than private insurance. It can do it by not having to generate profits or pay the CEO salaries. $12 million is the average CEO salary of a private health insurance company. And basically, it can do it by caring about the public health generally. A lot of the conversation among policy people is, how do we create a delivery system that puts an emphasis on what works, that rewards providers for what works, that invests in community health, invests in primary care? And, you know, if we don't have a public option, all we're doing in healthcare reform is rearranging deck chairs in the Titanic, and you might call insurance regulation giving those deck chairs a shiny coat of paint. But we need to do more than that. We need to change the whole dynamic, and the idea of having a robust public option is to create an insurer that has the clout to lower prices and the mission to public's health first, people's health first, which is what we need to do to keep the insurance companies honest.
Again, Richard Kirsch is National Campaign Director for Healthcare for Americans. At his news conference this week, the president was asked about insurance company contentions that they will be driven out of business if there is a public option. Here's how the president responded.
If private insurers say that the marketplace provides the best quality healthcare, if they tell us that they're offering a good deal, then why is it that the government, which they say can't run anything, suddenly is going to drive them out of business? That's not logical.
President Obama earlier this week. Michael Cannon is Director of Health Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. Michael Cannon, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
As someone who is opposed to the public option, as I understand it, how do you respond to what the president just said?
Well, the president was being a little bit disingenuous because later in the same press conference, he said that there are legitimate concerns that the government might give unfair advantages to its own program that would undercut the premiums of private health insurers. So I think that that actually understates the case, that there can't be ever really a level playing field between a government program and private insurance because government can always hide the cost. It doesn't really lower the cost of its activities, but it can hide the cost of its activities from enrollees' premiums so that it appears less expensive, the government program does, even if it's more expensive than private insurance. If we could have a level playing field between government programs and private health insurance, I would have no problem with the government competing on a level playing field. The problem is that level playing field cannot ever exist.
Why do you say that? Why would the government hide its costs?
Well, it's number one, because some people have an ideological preference for government-provided health care, which is fine. But the way that government operates provides countless opportunities for them to use the government's power to hide the cost of those plans. So here's one example. The private insurance companies have to pay corporate income taxes, and they have to pay taxes on the earnings from their investments. A government health insurance program wouldn't have any corporate earnings, and it wouldn't have any investments that it would have to pay taxes on. And so the government not only doesn't have to incur that cost, it can ratchet up those tax rates on private insurance companies so as to force them to increase their premiums and make the government plan look relatively more attractive. The government can do other things to subsidize its own program at the expense of private insurance. For example, the Medicaid program has price controls for prescription drugs that reduce the prices paid by the Medicaid program, but increase the prices that are paid by private insurance companies. And you go down the line, and there are all sorts of different ways that the government can do this. Favor its own plan, allow it to undercut the premiums of private insurers. And if you ask the people who came up with this idea for a competing government plan, they will admit that the point is to move all Americans into one government program. And so this rhetoric of choice and competition and keeping private insurance companies honest is really just a smokescreen for what is a proposal that's designed to move all of Americans into a government health program.
All right. Michael Cannon, again, Director of Health Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. I should say we asked the insurance industry to participate in our program. We told them who was going to be on. They declined to participate. Richard Kirsch, back to you, National Campaign Director for Health Care for Americans. What about this? They just simply can't be a level playing field, and the real goal is to get a single-payer system.
Well, that's simply not true. The goal is to actually have a system of private and public insurance that compete. And here's the thing that's extraordinary to me, Warren. You've got these private insurance companies whining. These companies have 150 million customers already in place. They have spent billions and billions and billions of dollars on marketing and building up name recognition. They have a national network of healthcare providers and contracts all around the country. They have contracts with businesses that do business with them. And they're whining that they can't compete with the government? I mean, this is outrageous. As the president said, it's not at all logical. What this is very simple, though. We have a system in this country where healthcare insurance premiums have been outpacing wages by four times the national average. And in some states, a state like Michigan, 17 times wages in a state that's suppressed. Insurance premiums go through the roof and people in Michigan are losing their wages. We cannot simply continue to have control health care costs if we're going to continue to rely solely on private insurance. They need to see if they compete with a plan. And the fact that they think they can't, despite the fact that they've got these huge advantages, and they will continue, no matter the laws that are passed. You can pass all the laws you want. We've seen in Medicare that even where there's laws about a level playing field in terms of accepting people who have higher risk and all those things you can do in Medicare, they still manage to rip off the government by equivalent of about $18 billion a year by cherry-picking, by getting around the system. So if what Americans say and I'd love to talk about the polling in this. When three-quarters of Americans say they want a choice of a public or private health insurance, it's because Americans understand, and this is also what the polls have shown, that government can do a better job controlling costs of private insurance. And one thing Americans know in their guts is with the delays and the denials of private insurance, that the last thing they want to do is make that the only choice. And if the reason insurance companies can't compete is because maybe they know that Americans don't trust them so much that they'll have to actually abandon the public insurance.
Richard Kirsch again with Healthcare for Americans, a group that had protesters, thousands of them, on the streets of Capitol Hill earlier today. Michael Cannon, back to you at the Cato Institute. Your response.
Well, I think that Richard makes my case for me. For example, among the ways that the government the private insurance companies have a lot of market clout. I think we need more competition in private insurance markets. But one thing that they cannot do, as the president said, is print money. They cannot tax people to subsidize their operations. The government can do that, and that completely swamps any advantages that Richard might have been talking about. The government can also create what is called an implicit guarantee, that it will bail out its program if the premiums are insufficient to cover its costs. There existed an implicit guarantee like that for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That implicit guarantee was estimated to deliver a subsidy of $6 billion per year to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That estimate comes from, actually, Larry Summers, who's one of Obama's economic advisors. And unless you can say that a new government program will not have an implicit guarantee, that no one will believe that it has that implicit guarantee, and that no future Congress will ever create that implicit guarantee, you cannot say there's anything resembling a level playing field. Also, in the Medicare program, the playing field is never level because the price controls that are given to that the government uses to pay private insurance companies are always subject to political manipulation. And in January, President-elect Obama suggested throwing the private insurers out of Medicare entirely. Now, that's not a level playing field. That's a cliff. And that's the sort of political manipulation that you get of the playing field when the government enters a marketplace and you try to have this sort of public-private competition.
So, Richard Kirsch, certainly the government then does have powers that the private sector does not.
Yes, but first of all, what Mr. Cannon has just said is totally untrue. The president didn't say he's going to throw private insurers out of Medicare. He simply said we're going to stop overpaying them $17 billion a year because they're providing the same services but charging a lot more than the government can do it. And in terms of this question of, first of all, government subsidies, the plan that's moving through both houses of Congress and that President Obama supports does not provide more subsidies to the government plan. What it does say is that under reform, people who don't get health coverage at work and small businesses would get health coverage through a new marketplace, and the subsidy would go to whichever plan they choose, private or public. So we're not talking about subsidizing the public insurance plan any more than the private.
Okay. Now we're going to take a brief break. We'll come back, continue this conversation, and talk very specifically about the ways in which the message is being shaped by the different players, including Richard Kirsch, who once again had demonstrators on the streets of Capitol Hill trying to persuade the Congress to go his way. On Reporter's Notebook later, Governor Mark Sanford and the Republican Party. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point, once again talking about the public option for health care insurance being considered as part of health care reform. We've been debating that and its pros and cons. Directly earlier, Drew Armstrong, health care reporter for Congressional Quarterly, was telling us how this broke down in the Congress with liberal Democrats on the one side, Republicans on the other, moderate Democrats sort of on the middle, partly for ideological reasons. William Bill Allison is a senior fellow at the Sunlight Foundation. That's a grant-making organization, a research organization in Washington dedicated to creating more government transparency online. Bill Allison, good to have you on our program.
Well, thank you for having me, Warren.
Tell us a bit about how this works in the Congress when the insurance industry, we heard about the relative power of the insurance industry and the government in terms of running a plan, but what about their relative power for persuading Congress people to do things?
Well, I think they have, tremendous power to
to influence Congress. You know, it's one of the biggest sectors in terms of giving money to members of Congress, in terms of campaign contributions. There's also the lobbying. And when you kind of look at, for example, a member like Max Baucus, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, which is crucial in getting this legislation through, several of his former staffers are now representing industry groups, YF Labs, pharmaceutical companies, insurers, and others with a serious interest in how this healthcare legislation is passed. And they have the ability to, and one of the reasons why they're in such demand as lobbyists is that they have greater access to members, and not just Senator Baucus himself, but their other colleagues in Congress. And what they're able to do is to help change the terms of the debate by having this influence and this access to members of Congress that the general public doesn't have.
What about money?
Money is critical. It's amazing when you look at the amount of money that's being put into this fight. And, you can just go through lists of members of Congress and the amount of money that they're getting. The Center for Responsive Politics, which is a grantee of ours, just put up a page showing for every member of Congress what they're getting from the health sector. They break it down with insurance, pharmaceutical, health professionals, hospitals, and nursing homes. And you just go down member by member, and you're talking about even House members, these dollar amounts totaling in the millions that they've gotten over the course of their careers from these vested interests that have a real stake in what happens with health care.
Here's part of that list. Top 20 recipients of healthcare industry money in the Senate. John McCain, $7 million. John Kerry, Democrat, of course, $7 million. Arlen Specter, Republican, $2 million. Max Baucus, $1,795,000. Those are significant amounts of money for anybody, are they not?
Yeah, definitely. One of the reasons I think that you're seeing McCain and Kerry at the top of that list is that having run for president and obviously still being in the Senate, I believe that they include the contributions to their presidential campaigns, which will tend to fluff up any members' receipts.
Good point.
But that being said, yeah, I mean, this is an industry that, but of course, McCain has been on the Commerce Committee, and Senator Kerry has been on a number of committees that have jurisdiction over this. So it's not as if that when somebody's running for president, even if they don't become president, it's not like it's a wasted contribution, and they'll still have, I don't think a member of Congress is going to say to a contributor, you gave to my presidential campaign and I lost, so I'm not going to listen to you. Instead, they're going to say, you're a supporter who helped me out when I was running for president. What can I do for you?
Here are the top 20 recipients in the House. I won't read them all, obviously, but we have at the top Tom Price, Republican of Georgia, $2 million. Frank, I don't know if it's Pallone or Pallone, Democrat of New Jersey, $1.6 million. And then other, both Republicans and Democrats, in the neighborhood of $1 million apiece. That's a lot for a congressperson. Are they on relevant committees?
Representative Price is actually, what's interesting about him is that he's actually a physician. So he comes from a, I believe he comes from a background there. But with the House members, one of the things we're finding is not just the amount of money that's coming in. There's just been a tremendous number of fundraisers being held this past week or a couple of weeks. There were 240 fundraisers in Washington over the last 4 days. And, there's 28 for members of Ways and Means Committee, Senate Finance Committee, the Health Committee, and many of them trace back to actually healthcare industry lobbyists, they are these invitations go out asking members to come and sit on, asking donors to come sit down with a member of Congress for a health industry breakfast or lunch or evening of drinks or whatever. And so what we're seeing is just a tremendous amount of lobbying and campaign contributions around this issue right now, and members raising a tremendous amount of money over it as well.
We heard earlier about the difference between liberal Democrats, moderate Democrats, and so on this issue. Is there any indication that the moderate Democrats, the so-called blue dog Democrats, got more money from the insurance industry, healthcare industry, than others?
That's one of the things that is harder to parse, but it does look like that, yes, that they are getting more money and that this has been a target. There's certainly been several fundraisers, invitations that have gone out where it talks about a specific member and it's a health industry luncheon, and it says that this is a member of the Blue Dog Coalition. So we're seeing that in the fundraisers. We have a site called politicalpartytime.org where you can look these things up for yourself. and you can search. You can't search for the blue dogs, but you can search for the healthcare industry. And as you go through these invitations, you see that the blue dogs are listed pretty frequently, and they're being identified by the folks who are hosting these fundraisers as this is somebody that you should be talking to, contributing to, coming to this fundraiser, sitting down with him behind closed doors, writing, you know, $1,000 checks or for PACs, $5,000 checks to his campaign, and talking about what you want out of the health care bill.
So obviously they're targeted in part because of their ideology.
I would say so, yeah, that you know, when you're looking at Congress and you're looking at, you know, where each of these different where these different members stand, you know, the key is, especially when you have, you know, we have with Republicans being having fallen to such a small number that Democrats really can, depending on what happens with Minnesota, with Democrats really being able to control the terms of the debate, there's much more focus on moderate Democrats and blue, so-called blue dog Democrats as being a key target for lobbyists and others seeking to have some kind of leverage or influence on this debate. And again, a lot of times what lobbyists are looking for is not necessarily that they're trying to kill the reform or to kill the entire package. What they're trying to do is to save whatever interest they represent. And, you know, when you talk about something like the public option, you know, this is what becomes the focal point of a lot of the campaigns, that this is the thing that will ruin us and take this out and we'll be fine and we can go along with some kind of a reform.
Again, Bill Allison is senior fellow at the Sunlight Foundation. I want to go back to Michael Cannon, director of health policy studies at the Cato Institute. You were talking earlier about the advantages that the government would have over the private companies if, in fact, there were competing insurance coverage. What about this advantage in terms of the debate when the insurance company can put the companies can put this kind of money into the Congress?
Well, I think what that what those numbers indicate more than anything else is how many of our healthcare decisions are already made by the federal government, and that the insurance industry and other healthcare providers are spending all that money because they're trying to influence those decisions. And generally, what they're trying to do is tilt the playing field in all of their markets in their direction. So I think that we can expect more of the same if the government gets even more heavily involved. So I think the solution there is to get government out of these decisions, create a more level playing field in the private sector, and have the insurers compete on the basis of who can provide us higher quality care and better coverage at a lower cost, rather than on the basis of which politicians they can influence.
Richard Kirsch, very briefly, with Healthcare for America Now, we want to respond to that.
Yeah, I mean, we've had insurance companies supposedly competing on higher quality and lower cost, and look where it's gotten us with the cost going through the roof, bankrupting families and businesses. The point Bill makes is very simple. I mean, Healthcare for America Now, the reason we had 10,000 people in Washington today is because the only way we're going to beat the kind of money that Bill was talking about is with the American people's voices. The fact that 3 out of 4 Americans want the choice of public health insurance option is one indication, but there's a lot of other things going on in reform here that the American public really, really wants, and that the vested interests in Washington don't want to see happen.
Okay. Remember what Drew Armstrong said a little earlier, though, about the polls and the fact that they are not, as he regarded, terribly nuanced. And once it gets down to the question of whether you're going to pay for this with taxes or cuts in other programs, it does become more complicated. I want to introduce the final guest here on this segment of our program, Wendell Potter. He's a senior fellow on healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy. That's a watchdog group based in Madison, Wisconsin. Until last year, he was head of corporate communications for Cigna. That is the country's fourth largest insurer. Wendell Potter, good to have you on our program.
Thanks very much for the opportunity.
You made quite a change.
I did. A very remarkable change, and very happy to have done it.
Why'd you do it?
I came to realize after 20 years in the industry that the insurance industry was not, as I was having to say, part of the solution. It is part of the problem. It is one of the big reasons why our healthcare system has become as dysfunctional as it is and doesn't work for so many millions of Americans.
Well, rather than debating with you the pros and cons of the public option, for example, tell us, if you will, about how the message is constructed, and you had a role in that.
I did, over many years. In fact, going back to 1993-94 during the debate over the Clinton reform plan. In fact, many times it's almost like the movie Groundhog Day, because I'm seeing the same things being played out again this time as played out last time. The private insurers would go to Washington and would assure members of Congress that they were for reform. They were for community rating. They were for getting rid of pre-existing conditions and cherry-picking. And they were for this and that. They're saying the same things right now. That is the what they want you to hear, the part that makes them appear to be favoring reform and on the wearing the white hats. Behind the scenes, though, it's an entirely different matter. They work through their third party advocates, through front groups, through think tanks, and through conservative talk show hosts, people who are more ideologically aligned with them, including business groups, to carry the negative messages for them.
So there's a conflict there, but is there anything necessarily wrong with that?
I think it is wrong if you are hiding behind front groups and not disclosing that you are funding them, which has been going on for a long time. People may know that, and after a while, it may seem, well, that's just the way things are done. It's not the way things should be done.
What are some of the negative messages that you you mentioned? You said that they are in favor of getting rid of pre-existing, or they say they're in favor of getting rid of pre-existing conditions, and of cherry-picking, same thing, people who are healthy as their insurees. What are the messages that they're putting out to get what they really want?
It's fear-mongering, and that's exactly what happened in 1993 and 94, and it's just we're just reaching that point now where it's reaching a peak. They will use those who are ideologically aligned with them to make people fearful of the government program, make people believe that it would lead us down the road to socialized medicine or, as you were talking earlier, down the road to a single-payer system, which it is not at all. But that is part of the scare tactics that goes on, and it's beginning to happen now. You see it through some of the conservative advertising of trying to scare people away from programs or making people think that what we're proposing is one system like in Canada or the United Kingdom. That's not at all what's being proposed, but they are trying to scare people that that's the kind of system that we will have, and here is why that is a bad thing.
You were on the other side of this for a long time. Were you doing something that was dishonest?
I honestly think that by representing or being a part of the industry working on task forces or coalitions that had been formed, one in particular was the Health Benefits Coalition, which was formed soon after the end of the Clinton plan. After that, there was what the industry referred to as anti-managed care legislation, one of which was the Patient's Bill of Rights. The industry pulled out all the stops to kill the Patient's Bill of Rights, and they did. But it was largely working through a front group called the Health Benefits Coalition, which the industry funded very heavily. But it was being the perception was that they cultivated was that it was a broad-based business coalition.
Wendell Potter, again, now the senior fellow on healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin. Let me go all the way back to the beginning of our program to Drew Armstrong, healthcare reporter for Congressional Quarterly. Is Congress aware of the kind of thing that Wendell Potter is talking about?
Yeah, they're very aware because a lot of that is happening in the debate that's being conducted in Congress right now. Republicans in the House and the Senate, I believe about a month ago, had a visit from a gentleman named Frank Luntz, who used to do a lot of strategy and messaging for the Republican Party. And he's also a very influential pollster and does a lot of – he's the guy who did Words That Work. He invented the phrase the death tax. And he did some work for them recently on how to talk about health care. One of the things in his presentation that he gave to House Republicans was that, you know, first and foremost, you have to be for reform. But he also said that to stop what Democrats are trying to do, you have to tell people that they are going to delay care, deny care, and ration care. And if you listen to what's being said in Congress, that's one of the primary Republican arguments that's being made by the folks who appear to be looking to try and stop this. another point Wendell brought up was this use of front groups by the insurance industry and these sort of astroturf, you know, lobbying efforts. One of the things we've seen a lot of is that the insurance company has been, the insurance industry has been very good at trying to position this debate as being not about their companies, but about being about the patients that they insure. You know, make this about the people on the ground, make this about their Medicare beneficiaries that they insure through Medicare Advantage or the Part D program. They work very hard not to make it about the insurance company. It's always about the patient, and that can be a very effective strategy.
On the other hand, the Democrats, do they not have their own person doing this? There's a woman named Celinda Lake who told the Democrats to talk about affordability and quality instead of words like government.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the big messages that they've been trying to put out, and Celinda Lake has been doing this. She's a Democratic pollster, and also David Axelrod, who works over at the White House as a political consultant. You know, you got to talk about what does it mean for the American people in terms of getting their costs lower. They tell them, the Democrats, to say, you know, if you like what you have, you can keep it. A lot of it is, you know, counters to these Republican talking points because they're playing a little bit of defense on stuff like that. And other stuff is making sure people feel comfortable with the change that they wanted, that they want to implement. So it's a lot of reassuring messages. You know, you'll keep what you have. It's going to cost less. A lot of that is the is how you try to sell these changes that they're trying to make.
Richard Kirsch, back to you with Healthcare for America Now. Quality and affordable, those are terms that you use. Did they come from Celinda Lake? Are you part of this as well?
Well, quality, affordable healthcare, the answer is yes. I actually spent several years of the big research project working with Celinda. But I want to tell you that phrase, quality, affordable healthcare, President Bush used it in his 2003 State of the Union. And the insurance industry's current front group, Campaign for American Solution, uses quality, affordable health care. So everybody uses that, but the question is how you define it. And when we start defining it by things like talking about keeping the insurance companies honest or being sure that your health care meets all your needs and giving it more definition is where the debate starts breaking down. And Drew's right. The opposition's main tactics, and it's the same thing Mr. Potter said, are scare tactics. They have to scare people against change, and we have to reassure people that they can keep the things they like, but also remind them of why there's such a crying need for change.
Wendell Potter, quickly, when you were working for Cigna, the country's fourth largest insurer, what did you do when slogans such as we've heard began to be adopted by both sides? What do you do then? How do you counter that?
Well, you go back to your core messages. The industry does a lot of work in research with focus groups to refine messages, making sure what you want to say. And it's exactly right that the industry is looking to try to shift to patient care because the industry's image is at its lowest point ever, and it knows that, so it has to resort to these kinds of messaging to deflect that.
And to what extent does it depend on contributions to politicians to get them to act the way it wants them to?
Oh, a lot. One of the responsibilities I had, I was the person who administered the Political Action Committee, and over the years, when the Republicans were in power, about 80% of contributions would go to Republicans, but when they saw that they political spectrum was beginning to change a little bit, they started contributing a bit more to Democrats, and that's changed quite a bit. But right now, most of the individual companies have four or five different lobbying firms on retainer, Republicans and Democrats. So they are, you know, they're playing everything, both sides of the fence, and very very sadly.
Okay. Well, I want to thank all of you for being with us on this program. We'll see how this debate works out. Wendell Potter, once again, is now at the Center for Media and Democracy, formerly was head of corporate communications for Cigna. I had that job for more than 20 years. William Allison, Bill Allison, is at the Sunlight Foundation looking for government transparency. Richard Kirsch is with Healthcare for America Now. Michael Cannon with the Cato Institute and Drew Armstrong with Congressional Quarterly. Thanks, all of you, for being with us today. Family values took another hit yesterday from South Carolina's Republican Governor Mark Sanford, who explained his five-day disappearance as a tryst with a mistress in Argentina. More on the governor and his party in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To the Point.
More on Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Yesterday, Governor Mark Sanford, no longer missing, apologized to his wife, his sons, his staff, and anybody who lives in South Carolina before he got to the point about where he'd been and why he went there.
And so, oddly enough, I spent the last 5 days of my life crying in Argentina, so I could repeat it when I came back here, in saying, you know, while indeed from a heart level there was something real, it was a place based on the fiduciary relationship I had to the people of South Carolina, based on my boys, based on my wife, based on where I was in life, based on where she was in life, a place I couldn't go and she couldn't go.
Dana Milbank is national political reporter for The Washington Post. Dana, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Warren.
This is quite a remarkable story, is it not? Does it appear that the governor was coming back from Argentina all ready to do what he did yesterday and reveal everything, or does it seem to be have been done at the spur of the moment?
You know, everything in politics is always so scripted and done just right with the pollsters and the image makers. And I think here we finally had an instant where this guy was clearly thinking it through his own brain as it was sort of coming out his mouth there. And it was very raw, and it was extremely unusual. And it gets more unusual by the moment. He's now scheduled another press conference for tomorrow. I think we could, you know, start selling tickets to these things.
Do you think he's going to, well, hard to ask for a prediction of this kind, but one wonders if he might want to resign as governor of South Carolina.
Well, yeah, a lot of people close him say he has no interest in doing that. On the other hand, you don't, you know, schedule a press conference to say, you know, I'm going out to lunch now.
He talked yesterday about the need to protect yourself when you're in public office. Let's hear a bit about what he said on that score.
And it began just on a very casual basis. Hey, I got this issue that's come up with my life, or vice versa. What do you think? Because when you live in the zone of politics, you can't ever let your guard down. You can't ever say, hey, what do you think? Or what do you think? Because it could be a front page story, or this story, or that story. And so there was this zone of protectedness in that she lives thousands of miles away and I was up here and you could throw an idea out or vice versa. And we developed a remarkable friendship over those 8 years.
Back to Dana Milbank. That sounds sort of like musing. I mean, he didn't get that from political consultant who was telling him what to say.
But he certainly didn't. And usually these things are sort of pro forma. You know, sometimes you get the wife to sit next to you, stand next to you and suffer. And usually it's a perfunctory apology, not taking any questions. And that's the end of it. But you saw it in his press conference. You also saw it in these descriptive emails that the state newspaper there in Columbia put out. And this guy was clearly anguished, both in the conversations with his mistress and in this very public forum in the state house yesterday, just sort of going through the all the emotions right there in public.
You have to wonder who would get access to such a very personal emails as those, and why the governor wasn't more careful about it.
You know, it happens over and over again, Warren. It's like, don't put things that you don't want out in public in emails. They always have a way of getting out there, and it happens over and over again. I suppose we shouldn't be complaining. It's probably good for our line of work.
Good for our line of work, for sure. But what about the Republican Party now, with John Ensign having had a similar kind of revelation, and now Governor Sanford, to both of them? I don't know if they were considered political or presidential candidates as much before they made these declarations as they have been since they have made these declarations. But what about the impact on the party itself?
Well, certainly one of the happiest people in the world right now is John Ensign, since we're, you know, now talking about Mark Sanford instead of him. And as another little footnote to history, these guys had been for a period of time roommates in the Capitol. But I mean, in terms of the larger Republican Party, look, they are at the lowest point that they've been at least in decades. So from one point of view, you could say, well, how much worse could it get? On the other hand, this just delays the any sort of rebuilding process because it demoralizes the religious conservatives who are the base of the party and who are
given two new reasons to say, hey, these guys say one thing and do another.
Well, does that mean that the religious conservatives are going to vote differently, or that they won't vote at all, or what's the likely?
That's usually what it is. They it sort of get depressed, demoralized, and don't turn out. It's not as if suddenly a lot of fundamentalist Christians are going to be, you know, pushing to keep Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House.
We all remember what has happened on the Democratic side with Eliot Spitzer and the former senator from North Carolina as well, presidential candidate for real. Has it had a greater effect, or does this have a greater effect on the Republicans because they emphasize family values more than it does on the Democrats?
You know, I mean, first of all, I guess it hardly even needs to be said, but it definitely seems to be that this abuse of whatever prerogatives one has in power seems to be a bipartisan affair. Both politicians of both sides seem to get a sense that whatever has happened to others who have been found out, it won't happen to them. So that seems to be utterly universal. In general, the tradition has been that the sex scandals are less damaging to the Democrats because they have there's not the hypocrisy issue there, although I think anybody who knows Eliot Spitzer would take issue with that statement.
And probably so. Senator Craig attempted to stay in office after the revelation that he had approached another man in a men's room in the Minnesota airport. Can you stay in office and be effective after something like this?
Well, in that case, ironically enough, it was John Ensign who was leading the charge to drum him out of the Senate, which is why Senator Ensign was in particular difficulty until his friend Mark Sanford took the heat off of him.
Dana Milbank, always good to talk with you.
My pleasure. Thanks.
National political reporter for The Washington Post. Today's program produced by Francis Anderton with Gary Scott and Carolyn Radziner, technical director Mike Newport. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/to the point. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.